Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another Wednesday edition of Sports Conversation. I'm Don Henderson. We're on the Fightin' Network. And, of course, we've got a great group of guests to talk to you this evening about what's happening in the world of sports. Roy Cummings is in Tampa, Florida, as always, covering the Lightning, covering the Rays, covering the Bucks. And Roger Hendler is in Atlanta, permanently stationed now in Atlanta, and he gets all the information coming down that way. And so we'll get right into it tonight. Roy, let's go right to you in Tampa. And we'll start off by talking about the basketball. We don't normally talk about college basketball, whether it be women's basketball or men's basketball. But we got to at least take a couple minutes at the top of the show because of the tremendous ratings that the women got for not only the semifinals but also the finals and the caliber of competition. And, Roy, I don't know if you had a chance to watch much of it, but I'll tell you, I saw most all of it. And it was very, very compelling.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I saw a good chunk of it myself and throughout the tournament, paid a lot of attention to it, really. And, you know, I think the ratings are primarily driven by by Caitlin Clark, which is fine. You know, ratings for a lot of sports are driven by superstars, and that's fine. But what I hope people discovered is that the women's game is a darn good basketball game. And if you're a purist, really, basketball purist, if you're not, you know, if you're kind of bored by the, you know, the constant slam dunks and three pointers that you see in the NBA, you know, you can see a different brand of basketball when you watch the women's game. And to me, it's very interesting. You know, not everybody has the same athleticism, but as the men. But at the end of the day, there's tremendous athletes and tremendous basketball players all throughout the women's game and the college level. And I hope people got a chance to see them. And again, you know, as great as Caitlin Clark is, one person's not good enough even on a great team to beat a team that's one of the teams of, you know, a legendary team in the South Carolina team. I mean, just incredible team. And unfortunately, a little bit overshadowed, I think, by Caitlin Clark. But you know what? Again, that's sometimes what happens with when you've got a superstar involved. You know, there's a lot of teams out there in the NBA that are better than the Lakers, but they've got LeBron, so he gets most of the attention. But that's how it is. But yes, watch that, and look, the men's tournament didn't disappoint either. You know, I think if you've been following it the last few years, you know that Purdue has, you know, had some trouble getting playing up to their what should be their level, and this year they played to that level and got to the championship game. And at the end of the day, despite having a superstar of their own in Edie, just not good enough to beat the best team in the land, which is clearly Connecticut. And so, look, you know, the basketball tournament, men's or women's, it tends to always be a little bit better to me than the college football tournament. And maybe that's what college football is trying to get to with 12 teams going forward. Maybe they're just trying to get something a little bit more like that. I don't know if it's possible in football, but we do have the basketball tournament, and I'll tell you what, guys, men or women, never disappoints.
Roger, we had a little bit of an oar in the water here because Dawn Staley, of course, grew up in Philadelphia, played at Virginia for my good friend, and played for they got to the Final Four. I didn't quite make it to the finals when she was at Virginia. But very, very close, but not quite good enough, pretty much what we saw with Purdue, just not quite good enough. And, Roger, you've been involved not only coaching women's basketball, but your youngsters have played women's basketball. So you're very close to the sport, very close to the coaches. Some of your thoughts.
Well, I agree with Roy. The thing that has really irritated me since then is about the WNBA players, a number of them criticizing Caitlin Clark. I think it's pure jealousy. I talked to at the middle school today, the girls' basketball coach, and she has no time for the NBA or the WNBA. Well, I'm not an NBA fan. But I would just say that, in my opinion, and you're right, Don, I've been involved. I coached high school girls AAU. My daughter's been a high school coach in Northern Virginia and also in Pennsylvania. And I followed it. A big UConn fan as my daughter was growing up. And Rebecca Lobo especially. I thought that she and the gentleman, Rocco, I thought they just did a great job of doing the play-by-play in color. But I just am really surprised also about Dawn Staley's position on transgender playing in women's basketball. I'm totally against it. I think most women athletes are against it. We've seen that situation at Penn with the swimmer. And that, I thought, put a stain on her victory over Iowa in the championship, my opinion.
Yeah, I was surprised they got into that, too. It was the day after the championship. And
right.
Dawn has always been very, very tough. You know, she's a taskmaster. And just like what happened with with Connecticut. The Hurley boys are taskmasters, as their father were. I was a little disappointed they got into that, but I was also a little disappointed they got into whether it was a jealousy factor or what, that the African-Americans thought that she got too much publicity, that the WNBA is made up and has been made up and has been a success because of black athletes, which is absolutely true. But at the same time, this was a very unusual case. And Roy, maybe you have a thought or two about that. I just thought that was in poor taste to even get involved in that when the tournament was over.
Yeah, I got to be honest. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm right with you guys on all of this. I don't understand the criticism at all. I mean, good for Dawn Staley when, you know, she called, you know, she came out and said, look, thank you, Caitlin Clark, for putting a spotlight on our game. And to me, what else should we be doing except celebrating arguably the greatest basketball player in the history of the game? I mean, she's got more points than anybody. This is not by accident. This is not because she's playing against inferior competition. The competition's all level on the women's side, granted. And no one expects Caitlin Clark to go out and beat an NBA team or maybe even score 30 points against one, although she probably could. But at the end of the day, a lot of the criticism that we're hearing, a lot of the controversy, it's unfortunate to me, because it's like, can't we just celebrate the fact that we had a tremendous tournament, lots of stars were exposed to people who hadn't seen them before, the audience for the sport is growing, and at a time, and if you want to kill that, or, you know, drop that audience a little bit, I mean, you have some of these controversies. It's not necessary. It certainly isn't. And if this is what more attention to the game is going to bring, well then, maybe it should go back into the shadows, but I'm not a fan of that at all. I think that, you know, look, even the WNBA, the game is a good game. If you take the time to look at it, again, basketball purists will find something to appreciate about it, because it's not just a bunch of three-pointers. It's not just a bunch of dunks. It's not a power game. It's basketball the way it was meant to be played. And, you know, and I like it. I appreciate it, and I think more people will if they give it a chance.
Roger, we'll let you conclude this segment and talk about, because I agree with you 100%. If I were with Dawn Staley right now, I would disagree with her. I just don't think that you can have transgenders in any sport playing against women. I just don't think it's fair. And I think that a lot of the states that have taken to making rules against it are in the right direction. But I'll let you finish up on that, because you're the women's basketball coach.
Well, I agree. And just what Roy started out saying about the traditionalism of the women's game for basketball, it just reminded me of when I was a kid and watching the great NBA teams with the Warriors, and just thinking about Paul Arizin, Neil Johnston, Wilt, and everybody, everyone in the league. It wasn't slam dunks all the time. It wasn't showtime. It was traditional basketball, the give and go. And that's what you see with the women's game, and I know that's what I love about it.
Well, let's swing over now to the body and soul for Roy, and that's the National Hockey League right now. There's a lot of difference of opinion in all the papers around the country that I have read about what the Lightning are going to be able to do. The fact they started off rather slowly, they came on in the midseason. They had a streak where they won 8 out of 9, 9 out of 10. You get right back in the hunt. Roy, you're on top of it more than anybody. Your thoughts now as we look into the final 5 or 6 games of the regular season, and more importantly, as we look forward to the playoffs.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I mean, I understand the skepticism regarding the Lightning, because they weren't a great team at the beginning of the year. I think Nikita Kucherov is going to win the MVP award, because a lot of people look at the Lightning, and look, I've said it before, it's not a deep team. If you get past the first two lines, it thins out pretty quickly. If anybody gets hurt, it thins out, you know, dangerously for the Lightning. But at the same time, this is as battle-tested a team as there is. No team in the playoffs, outside of maybe Boston, which isn't quite the same Bruins team that we saw a year ago. You know, a couple of guys aren't there anymore. Let's face the facts. No other team is as battle-tested and as successful in those battles as the Lightning have been. The Lightning know exactly how to play come playoff time. And I still don't think Toronto knows how to play that way. I'm not sure Edmonton knows how to play that way. I think Colorado does, but I don't know if they can be consistent at it. I think Dallas is capable, but they have to show it. Same for Winnipeg, and same for the Rangers. And so, the one team I think that has figured it out and could challenge the Lightning, and they very well may end up facing them, is Florida. So, you know, watch out for the Lightning. And number one, the number one reason you watch out for the Lightning is because the goaltender. We all know that goaltending is what carries you in the playoffs. If you've got it and you've got it better than anybody else, you're probably going to go somewhere. You know, the Lightning are a team that, and again, skepticism revolves around the fact that they are very heavy power play team. They really rely on their power play. But, you know, they're fast. They're smart. If you take a penalty against them, and it's hard not to sometimes because they play tough in front of their own net, tougher than they used to, and they've got that grit, watch out. So, look, I think the Lightning are a team to watch. I would put them in the top five or six of the favorites. Despite the fact that, you know, they're a wild card entry this time around. But, you know, if anything, if the NHL playoffs has taught us anything, it's like, yeah, okay, so. I mean, the eighth seed beats the first seed, not consistently, but, you know, often enough that we're not surprised by it anymore. So watch out for the Lightning. They've got everything you need to be to go deep into this playoff tournament. And I won't be surprised at all if they're there at the end playing for at least the conference title.
Roger, you were in Philadelphia a great part of the year before coming back to Atlanta to stay. And Tork tried very, very hard to turn the franchise around in Philadelphia, did a pretty successful job. And your thoughts right now is they're right on the borderline now of being able to make it or not make it.
Well, they've really been in a free fall, and it's a shame because – they were like 10 games over 500, and all of a sudden I think they're down to four. I don't know whether that's just an indication of where they are lacking talent right now, or because Tort did a great job. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We all agree. And I just don't know what has happened, but I guess if they can make it into the playoffs, hopefully they may be able to turn it around some. If they can win a couple of games, I think that'll give everybody some confidence. But right now, they're not looking good at all.
We jump back, and Roy, take a look. As you mentioned, all the teams you just mentioned that have sort of gotten into a role where they can make a threat at the Lightning and maybe even beat the Lightning. We'll have to wait and see what happens as the season goes along. But that 3, 4, and 5 spot is, of course, we go down to the other division. The Rangers have a lot of confidence going in. They've lost a couple of people because of injury, and whether they're going to be back and ready to play, I don't know. But the Rangers, everybody thinks this is the year that they're finally going to get to the Stanley Cup Finals. Whether they do or not, I don't know. The Islanders are right on the borderline as well. Some of the teams that have been going back and forth, Roy, how do you see it getting, not the play-ins or anything, but getting into the actual tournament itself? What do you think?
Yeah, it's wide open. I mean, there's no doubt. I really think it is. Yes, you can make the argument that the Rangers are, you know, let's face it, the best team in the East point-wise, and every reason to believe that they can go deep as well. But again, you know, how good is Igor Shesterkin throughout the playoffs? You know,
Roy, let me interrupt for a second because you had a lot of great things to say about Laviolette when he was fired and also when he was hired by the Rangers. You talked about all the different teams that he had coached and he was a winner everywhere. and yet he was free to come in and take over the Rangers. So when you talk about that side of the division, talk about him as well. I think he's done a terrific, terrific job.
Oh, he has. What about it? And look, I still don't know and quite understand what the disconnect was with Gerard Gallant and the people in the front office in New York, but there clearly was a disconnect because you know what, they were a good team a year ago too under Gerard Gallant. But you know what, Peter Laviolette was kind of handed a Ferrari here, and all he had to do was kind of turn on the engine and just make sure he kept it between the lines, and he could easily win big. So I'm not surprised that the team is. Has succeeded and excelled this year under Peter Laviolette. He's got more playoff experience, obviously, than some coaches, and I think that's going to be really important going forward too. So, you look at the Rangers top to bottom, and there really isn't, there isn't a weakness there, and they're missing some players too. Philip Hedl is still not there, and Kako's just come back, so. Let's see how they shape up, but they're battle tested. They know what to look for, and they're probably as well equipped as anybody to play the grinding style that gets played in the playoffs. And if they get up against Boston, if they get up against Tampa or Florida, I think they're fine. And they've got the speed to take on Toronto as well. So if that's who they face, or Carolina. There's just a lot of depth in the East, and the Rangers clearly as good as there is. I mean, they're four at least, maybe five deep in on the blue line with Stars. I mean, Keandre Miller is a very underrated player, I think, in a lot of because he's overshadowed a little bit by Adam Fox and some of the others. And they got scoring galore. And again, that's another team that you can't let them have a power play because they'll hurt you too. So. Look, Peter Laviolette, they brought him in for this. This is what he was brought in for. Take this team to the next level, not just getting to the playoffs, not just winning a couple of rounds, but get them to the conference final and get them into the Stanley Cup final and win it. I think Peter Laviolette's poised to do that. Matchups matter. Breaks matter. A lot of things you can't control, but he'll have the Rangers as ready as anybody. And the Rangers, talent-wise and throughout the depth chart, they're as good as anybody. They've got everything you need, everything you want, and look for them to go deep as well.
Let me go back to you one more time before we go to baseball, Roy. And I'm not so sure that they're 100% sold on their goaltender yet. I mean, Love seems to make changes at odd times. It changed goaltenders two nights in a row, then it'll change. I'm not so sure he's as confident as certainly the Lightning would be with their goaltender because they know what he can do.
Yeah, well, the different – yeah, and I agree. And that was, what I was saying at the very beginning when I first started talking about the Rangers was it's about, Igor Shesterkin. I mean, how good is he? And what's it going to be like with him? Is he going to be on his game? He has moments where it seems like he just kind of loses focus, and when he does, his game becomes – truly ordinary, and you just can't afford that in the playoffs. So, how's he going to look? They're going to have to ride him. There's no doubt about that. I mean, it's not a question of, do you go to somewhere else? I mean, you could go to Jonathan Quick. I mean, he's certainly been there. He's done it. He's won before. He's won big games. He's the reason they're there because they needed a backup. And, but I think you have to ride one guy in the playoffs, and I think it's going to be Shesterkin, and they're going to either, sink or swim with him. But I'll say this. Early on, you lose if he looks bad early. They may make the switch early and go to Quick and ride him as long as they can because they just can't afford to have Shesterkin fall into that little slump that he falls into every occasionally where he just seems to zone out for two or three games and you can't have that year. So we'll see how it goes. He's had a very good season, obviously, but you know what? You look at the numbers and. Quicks are actually better than Shesterkin, but he's played half the minutes, so let's not get too excited there. But Shesterkin's got to play at a high level. I like the way he's played for the most part down the stretch. I think that's important. If he can maintain that focus and stay sharp, Yeah, Rangers are arguably the team to beat in the division or in the conference.
Steve Cassello is going to join us in the next segment, and so we'll switch over to baseball for a few minutes before he comes on. First of all, your thoughts, Roger, on the Phillies, and then we'll go to the Braves where you are right now.
Well, I think the Phillies are – I think they need a charge. They won today to beat the Cardinals 4-3. Nola had a good outing. He's now 2-1. But they're not hitting, and when Steve comes on, I have my own opinion about a move that they
well, let me hold you right there, Roger, because Steve, we'll bring the three of you on together now because Steve's on the line right now, so you can direct your question right to him.
Well,
Steve,
you know,
nice to have you join us.
Hey, good to be here.
Roy, maybe you have a baseball question for Steve before you know you leave.
Oh, let's continue to talk about the Phillies, who obviously off to a little bit of a disappointing start. But I would ask Steve, okay, you know, what are you seeing? I mean, personally, I look at the Phillies and I'm not concerned. 5-6 start right now, one today. That's nice. Maybe not hitting the way they have, but that hitting will come around. That lineup's too good. They'll hit when they have to, and they'll be there at the end. That's how I believe it. But Steve, I'd be interested in hearing your take on it. Again, it's early. Not concerned at this point.
Yeah, the one I was just talking about the Phillies the other day, and going to the point of the locker room, and you know, the last 2 years they've got off to slow starts. You know, 2 years ago with Girardi, and then they made the move to Thompson, and they took off, and then last year they got off to kind of a slow start, and then they took off. So in that room, those guys know how to go about their business, and they know it's a 162-game season. And as Roy mentioned, they're not hitting where they probably are going to end up hitting. They're not consistent with the lineup. I do like the bullpen, and I do like the rotation. Little concern about Aaron Nola today with the lack of velocity. Not a big drop in velo, but it could just be that coming out of camp, his arm is a little bit tired. I think we saw the same thing with Kevin Gausman earlier, last week. So I think patience for the Phillies, what are they, 6-6 now? And they just got to get a little bit of momentum. But if any locker room understands the 162, I think the Phillies do.
Well, before Roy leaves us and you two fellas follow the Rays as close as anybody does. So give me an idea, the two of you. It's a different year for the Rays. The Rays have always been able to sell everybody off and make moves and come up with people out of the minor leagues. And all of a sudden they blossom into competitive, not only competitive, but super competitive athletes. Roy, before you leave, we'll let you get your thoughts on where the Rays are right now in comparison to the last couple of years.
Well, they've obviously, it's kind of like the wells run dry in terms of finding, pitching within the system, I would say. They're really, shorthanded there. They've had some injuries that are really bothering them. They're kind of piecing it together right now. You know, I think hitting-wise, I think they're going to be okay. This is a team that's always figured out a way to manufacture runs, a little more power now than they've had in the past. So I think they're going to be okay there. I think they're going to manufacture runs, but I am concerned about the pitching staff. And, Steve's there on a nightly basis, so I'm anxious to hear from him. But, look, I'll just say this. When Zach Eflin's your ace, Aaron Civale's next, I'd say you got some issues. I think a lot of Ryan Pepiot. I think he's going to be a star in this league. I think he's probably their best starting pitcher. But, right now the biggest concern I would have for them, for the Rays, is, can the bullpen hold up as much as it seems like they're going to have to rely on it more than usual just because of the starters. They don't have a horse, really. Outside of Eflin, they just don't seem to have a horse and who can really give them some innings and go deep. And I think that hurts the bullpen, and I think that hurts the team overall. So they've run out, like I say, the well's kind of run dry a little bit in terms of prospects on the mound. And I'm anxious to hear what Steve has to say, and I'll just hang up and listen to that.
Okay, thank you very much, Roy. As always, Steve, we'll pick it right up from there and get your thoughts on. I like this concluding sentence. The well seems to have run dry, and even on the broadcast, on the telecast, I should say, they talked about the same thing, how difficult it has been now for the Rays to reach down into the minor leagues and find somebody that could come up and really help them immediately. So nobody covers numbers better than you do, Steve. So give us your thoughts on that first.
Yeah, the Rays generally don't produce their pitching from their minor leagues. They basically acquire it and bring it up. You take a look at the rotation. You got Shane McClanahan, a draft pick from a couple years ago, that came up and was, you know, a star right out of the chute. But, you know, Jeffrey Springs and Drew Rasmussen and Tyler Glasnow and Shane Baz, those are all guys that were acquired or converted into starters. They signed Zach Eflin as a free agent. They really don't, you know, the draft, the last 5 years, they really haven't taken a pitcher in the top two or three rounds in the draft. So, you know, as far as like going down and grabbing somebody, they're just waiting for Taj Bradley to get healthy. They've got Shane Baz coming back from his Tommy John surgery. He's healthy with the arm. And, you know, they expect him, you know, around, you know, June, July. And he's one of the top prospects in baseball. Jacob Lopez isn't anything to sneeze at. He's not great, but he's a viable arm. And another guy they traded for. But it's kind of funny when you look at the Rays. People think that they draft and develop starting pitchers, and that's how they get these great pitching staffs. But it couldn't be further from the truth. They haven't been drafting starting pitchers, and they haven't developed starting pitchers other than Shane McClanahan, as we know, is out with Tommy John surgery. The Rays have the best disabled, you know, best injured list starting rotation in the big leagues, unfortunately, when you look at Shane McClanahan and Shane Baz and Taj Bradley and Jeffrey Springs and Drew Rasmussen, and that's a heck of a five. They should be getting Springs back at around June. As far as not having horses, it's kind of interesting that the Rays' philosophy right now is to try to get 6 to 7 innings out of each and every starter. They've been letting these guys go a little bit longer, hoping to avoid having to use their bullpen as much as they have in years past. So if you notice, Eflin's been going 5 to 6 innings. Savali's been going 6. You know, they're letting – and Eflin's been going, you know, 5, 6. You know, today he had a pitch count issue. But very interesting organization. They are trying to do things a different way. But no argument with Roy that if you were, you know, picking a spot on the team where they're weaker than normal would be the starting rotation. A lot of it has to do with injury.
Roger, you're up.
Well, a couple of things, Steve. It's always great to talk to you. And this all circles around Mike Trout. A lot of talk here in Atlanta that the Braves are going to make a deal with the Angels to get Trout. And, of course, they've got problems now with Strider because they don't know what's going to happen to him. I mean, he could be, if worst comes to worst, he could be gone for the year, which could change everything as far as their pitching goes. But in my case, I would like to see the Phillies make a deal with the Angels, give up a pretty good prospect, but not one of the top pitchers, and also get rid of Castellanos. I think right now he is a total liability on that team. He's not mm-hmm. hitting, and I look at Trout, he's hit 6 home runs, and he's hitting .318 in the mm-hmm. early part of the season. So I was wondering what your thoughts about that. That way it would prevent the Braves from getting him, and they would have him, a homegrown guy, and he would love to be playing back in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that all sounds good. I don't know if you have enough equity to get Mike Trout. It's going to take more than a prospect, and they're not going to take Castellanos back in the deal. And Philadelphia would be where he'd want to go. He has 10-5 rights, and that does limit the return. You know, when a player has 10-5 rights or a no trade clause, the value on the trade market is pretty null. You know, you look at Giancarlo Stanton, for instance, as a guy that had no trade, that decided, you know, he determined where he went, which limited the trade return. I don't see Mike Trout going to Philadelphia in a trade. I just don't think there's no incentive for the Angels. You're never going to get value for Mike Trout. You know, you're just not going to get the value for him, and that would be like disrupting the entire organization for Artie Moreno to do that. Now, if we hear that Mike Trout is unhappy and wants to be traded, then I think later this season we can have a different dialogue. You know, if things go south again in Anaheim. But right now, I don't think there's any, you know, from a fan standpoint and from a business standpoint, you know, trading Mike Trout would be equivalent to Cleveland trading Kyle Avito back in the day. You know, you could have 30 years or 40 years of the curse of Trout on your hands. But not a bad idea to get him to Philly, though. I'll give you that. It's a good idea. He solved a lot of issues.
Yeah, and he's still very close to Philadelphia. He goes to all the Eagle games. He's very much close to us.
Oh, yeah.
All the articles in the paper during spring training and into the regular season, he's done now 4 or 5 interviews saying that there's no way that he's going to leave the Angels. He's going to stay right there. He's not going to be traded. I don't foresee him going to Atlanta, and I don't foresee him going to Philadelphia. He had all kinds of meetings in the off season with the owner, and they sort of came to an agreement that this is the way it was going to be, that he wanted to be there. He did not want to be traded, so I don't think he's going to. But, Steve, let's go in another direction. Give me some of the things that you think have surprised you in the early going. Now, I grant you that, you know, we're only talking at about 2 weeks, but give us some of the things. You keep the numbers better than anybody else. Some of the things that you think have surprised you.
Well, first thing that surprised me is the Red Sox starting rotation or the entire pitching staff up till yesterday having an ERA in 10 games of like 1.46. that was pretty impressive. You know, everybody out there looked good from, Tanner Houck to Pivetta to Brian Bello. I mean, everybody was looking really good. So that was surprising. The Yankees and Juan Soto, that's been a very fun week. They're off to a great start. You know, Alex Verdugo's fitting in perfect into that lineup, and of course Juan Soto is a beast. So that's been surprising. On the negative,
let me hold you right there for a second, Steve.
Yeah.
Has his defense surprised you? Because he won 2 games with his defense. Forget what the home run he hit and the bases he stole. I mean, his defense has been unbelievable.
Well, again, you know, making a nice play and being a good defender are 2 separate things. So I call it the old ESPN top 10 plays. You know, you see a guy on there and you think he's a good, you know, a good player. Soto's not a good glove, but he can make good plays. I mean, let's not be, you know, it's not like it's Marlon Byrd out there in right field, you know. You know, I had to pull a Philly guy. It's kind of like Norm Lane.
Andrew Jones.
Well, Andrew in center field was phenomenal. Maybe the best I've seen, you know. But Soto isn't Andrew Jones. But, the game-saving plays with the glove, he has brought quite a bit of energy to New York. And, you know, I'm not a Yankees fan, being in the same division with them and all the problems that the Rays and the Yankees have. But I'm also not, you know, I'll never say baseball isn't better with the Yankees being good, because it is. I mean, you have to have – they're the Darth Vader of Major League Baseball. And when they're not good – it's not as fun. You know, I like to see the Rays and the Yankees when the Yankees are winning 95 to 100 games and have that attitude. And they seem to get in a little bit of that swagger back, which is good. On the negative side, I really expected I expected just a little bit more out of the Marlins. You know, I knew the pitching injuries would get them. But I watched, being just out of general interest, I watched 3 or 4 of their games already, and they've just given them away. You know, 2 outs, nobody on, and ground ball to second, and Arias kicks it. And the next thing you know, the Cardinals put up 5 runs, you know, and take a lead in a couple of those games. So the whole situation in Miami kind of is the biggest thing that I've seen on the negative side. It's everybody down there is just struggling, and, you know, they just keep giving games away. And I thought they'd be a little bit better coming out of the chute, but – you know, like you say, it's early and there's so much going on right now. It's just fun.
Roger?
Well, I agree with you. And I know Don's a long-time Yankees fan, and it's been fun to watch them, and Soto especially, and the talent that they have. And I see them holding up throughout the year, but I also think that the Orioles are still the team to beat in the AL East. And do you see the Orioles falling off at all, Steve, this year?
The one thing I can tell you about the Orioles is I don't expect them to be nearly as dominant in the ninth and eighth, in the eighth and ninth inning with Cano and Kimbrel as they were with Cano in the last year. They're not gonna play seven inning. Last year was phenomenal. You go look at those two guys and what they did in the eighth and ninth inning. And if you were playing from ahead in the seventh inning on, that game was locked down. So I think you're going to see a little bit of regression there. The offense is struggling a little bit more than anybody expected right now. You know, the whole Jordan Westberg at second base thing didn't quite catch fire early in the year, so they're turning to Jackson Holliday, which will be fun and exciting. But that team has the bats. When the weather warms up, Brandon Hyde's a good manager. Going out and getting Corbin Burns was just a great move for them, you know, to give him a horse at the top of the rotation, kind of what Roy was referring to with the Rays not having a horse. You know, Zach Eflin isn't Corbin Burns. I watch Norfolk a lot on the minor league games, and that Norfolk team is loaded, and maybe those guys aren't going to be used at the big league level, but near the trade deadline, those guys will be used to give the Orioles that extra piece. So, you know, with the depth they have on the major league roster and what they have in Norfolk, they're loaded for bear to make a move or two at the deadline to really put themselves in a good position.
Steve, of all the things that surprised me a little bit, saw them in spring training here over in Bradenton, but the Pirates came out of the chute in great shape, and it's just nice to see them be a little bit competitive and be a part of Major League Baseball again.
Yeah, you know, last year they got off to a great start as well, and I didn't buy into it. I compared it to the Manny Act, the 2011 Cleveland team that got off to a 35-15 start and finished, I think, under 500. The Pirates just had this look of a team that was playing well but really wasn't a good team, and they came down to they came to play Tampa Bay and down in St. Pete, and, you know, it was a battle of, you know, the best in the NL and the best in the AL, and the Rays swept them. And I was like, yeah, that's not a very great team over there. But in the offseason, you know, they went out there and got some veteran arms,
right?
On that pitching staff, and getting O'Neill Cruz back has been great. The guys are another year old. Sawinski is another year older. Cabron Hayes, whatever he falls short with a bat, is a great defender. A great addition was Aroldis Chapman, and just the other day, you know, they were in an 8-5 game with the Reds, I think it was, and the bases were loaded, one out. It was actually the Tigers, excuse me. It was 8-5, bases loaded, one out. Javi Baez is coming up, and they went and got Aroldis Chapman in four pitches. He had struck out Baez, and the center fielder came up three pitches, and he disposed of him, and that ended the rally, and the Pirates went on to win. And, you know, that's not a game that they may have held on to last year in the second half of the season. But when you have guys like Aroldis Chapman to go out there, Jarek Shelton suddenly is a much better manager, you know. only issue right now is that a lot of times early in the year we have this magnification of closers that fail. You know, we saw Pete Fairbanks recently have a blow-up for the Tampa Bay Rays. And then yesterday I think David Bednar kind of blew a game for the Pirates. So that's got to be a little bit of a concern. You have to have confidence that Bednar will straighten it out, and they'll continue to have Chapman and Bednar in the eighth and ninth. But, yeah, it's a fun team. It really is. It's a pesky team, and Derek Shelton's got them going in the right direction. I like the team a lot more with this start than I did the team last year.
Roger?
Yeah, I agree, and I am happy, like Don, you are, the Pirates at least being back competitive. And I was just wondering, Steve, what your thoughts are about, like, the Nationals. Do you see any hope for the A's in the next, say, decade? I mean, I don't know where they're going to wind up, as far as location goes, but how do they just continue Major League Baseball to put up with such a situation as with the A's?
Well, they got that pretty much rectified now, Roger. Go ahead. Go ahead, yeah. Steve.
I'll take the second. I don't have an answer to the Major League Baseball dealing with the Oakland A's owner. I don't have an answer to that. We've seen, you know, everybody on this call knows Ted Stepien. We know Marge Schott. We know Art Modell. We know Irsay. You know, we know these owners that have done, you know, devious things. And each prospective sport has put up with it, you know. And I don't have the answer to why Major League Baseball is putting up with it. The other thing about the hope for the A's, you know, you guys know I'm big on organizations, you know, and the A's still have their front office intact with Billy Beane and I think it's David Frost over there. The A's have always been able to build very good teams very quickly, you know, not in the 6-8 year period, you know, not in that disappearing period. Things are really bad for them right now, but I have the sneaking suspicion that they're doing stuff that is going to come to the surface much more rapidly than anybody thinks. I'm very down on them right now. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I can't believe some of the talent that was there last year. That was one of the worst teams of all time. But there's a few things that I like. I won't get all into the thing, but there are some players there that I like, some pitchers there that I like that I think have some upside. And I think in the next couple of years, that, you know, we'll see a little boost from the A's moving forward.
Well, now that you've seen it all settled, they're going to move. They've already signed an agreement to move and play their games for the next, what, 2 and possibly 3 years and at the minor league facility. And also the hotel with the grounds in Vegas will officially be torn down next. I think it's the 8th or 9th of next month. It's going to be a big ceremony because it's the oldest hotel in Vegas and the property where they're building the stadium. And that's already been settled. So unlike what's happening in Tampa, where they're you know, still arguing about what they're going to do about money and so forth, this has all been taken care of, and they've got the leases for the next 3 years where they're going to play in a minor league facility. And then when they're, by the end of the third year, they'll be in Vegas in the new facility on the Strip. So I think they're well ahead of what most people think.
Well, rewinding a little bit, it's 3 years in Sacramento and possibly a fourth year.
Right.
And as far as the property in Vegas, they have no contract yet or financing in any way that's been locked in to build. And the big question is, where are they building this thing? They're tearing that hotel down, but the A's have that spot and another spot that they're still determining where they're going to play. Nothing is set. That's one of the things that is frustrating a lot of people right now is, they're moving to Sacramento. Nothing is set up in Vegas. That's what I thought you were referring to with how does Major League Baseball allow the A's to get away with this. They don't have anything in Vegas. They have ideas of Vegas. They don't have anything locked down yet.
Well, the way I read in last Sunday's paper, I thought they had some kind of formal agreement that the property where the hotel is being torn down is where the stadium is going to be, and that they were all set to continue on and move there, as you said, whether it would be 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, how long it's going to take them to build it. But I thought that was pretty much consummated.
Nope. That's what I thought you were referring to in reverse.
Well, then
you're
ahead of me. I thought the paper said Sunday that it was, the way I read it, it was consummated. They said the Pirates are coming in here when so this is going to be their new facility. So I just assumed that. I guess I should.
No, there's no ground. There's no. I don't think anybody's pulled a permit or there's a groundbreaking ceremony planned or anything like that. There's still a few hurdles now in both Tampa Bay and St. Pete and in Las Vegas. It's done. I mean, it's 99.9% done in my opinion. It's just everybody has their hand in the proverbial pot, and everybody has to make sure you get the right, you know, the right amount given to your organization or your political campaign. You know, again, you know, being a little bit older and going through this a number of times, you know, you kind of see where stadiums are at. But yeah, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see. you know, I have no problem with them playing in the smaller minor league park. I mean, down here in Dunedin, New York, I think it was upstate New York, I believe, where the Blue Jays played.
They played in
during
Buffalo.
COVID.
Yeah, they're
yeah,
AAA.
Played in Buffalo.
Yeah. They played in Buffalo.
Yeah, and they pulled that off, and it was nice. You know, I think you can do it.
Let
Roger,
me ask
you're
you,
up.
I don't know the hotel. What is the hotel they're going to knock down? Is it the Flamingo?
I forget now. We had a big picture of it in
the
papers. It's the oldest hotel. It's built in 1952. Oldest hotel on the strip.
The Tropicana. Dog.
Tropicana. That's
what
it is.
Tropicana. Okay.
That's
yeah,
it.
That
Tropicana.
Sorry,
oldest,
I can't
yeah.
get Mo Green out of my head right now. So I'm kind of, you know, I got the Mo Green thing going on. I'm trying to concentrate, but
Well, now the question is, Steve, do you think that Vegas really will care about having baseball?
It'll be interesting. I mean, you know, as the area grows, and you know, and it's a Major League Baseball team. I don't think they're going to be hurting for fans. There's going to be a honeymoon period. I don't know if there's going to be a sustained love of baseball. I mean, the Las Vegas Aces do pretty well as a minor league franchise. I mean, there is interest in the area. It's not like they're dropping baseball in where baseball has never been.
Right.
But with the amount of transplants and stuff, it'll be interesting. You know, there's going to be a honeymoon period and an energy period for the new park. And the way parks are designed now, it's not like, you know, 1970 when they would build these, you know, big round 70,000-seat stadiums. The idea is to build a stadium around 35,000 and have some expensive tickets in it. So, you know, it would be interesting. I'm not sure if the Oakland A's are going to bring enough oomph. You know, in history, it'll be interesting. It's we'll have to wait and see on that.
Well, see, I thought that Charlotte and Don and I have talked about this, and Frank, I thought Charlotte and Nashville would be a much better fit for the A's than Vegas, because it's mm-hmm. one thing to have an NFL team, you got a hockey team. And then you also got a basketball team, and then they, you know, they've got colleges there too. But I just thought that the city, they'd have to realign the structure of the divisions. I understand that, but I think with the growth in Nashville, which is booming, and also in Charlotte, I just felt that would be a much better fit for a baseball team than going to Vegas.
Well, yes, you're exactly right, and then Major League Baseball knew that. They wanted to keep the West Coast with the A's. Now you're going to get two expansion franchises. Shortly after the A's and the Rays take care of their business, you will be having two more expansion teams. That's billions of dollars for baseball, you know, that you have to buy in, you know, pay your buy-in. And, you know, then you're going to redo the divisions into eight divisions of four. That's the idea. There will be two more teams, and I think, you know, teams that will be considered will be Montreal will be considered, and Nashville and Carolina and Portland, and those are the kind of the markets, San Antonio even. You know, those are the markets that will be considered for expansion, and there will be two expansion teams shortly after. So right after the A's move into their new park and the Rays move into their new park, and that's, you know, getting close to moving in, Major League Baseball will probably start getting ready to expand to two more cities. I think the A's being on the West Coast and moving to the West Coast location keeps things static for now. You know, all the divisions stay the same, everything stays the same, and then as soon as that everything's locked in, okay, now it's time to expand and realign.
Well, I was going to go to the Red Sox next, but you just changed my mind when you say that the Rays are sort of settled. Give us an update on the Rays, because I can't foresee what's happening there.
Well, you've got a big project where a stadium's only a little bit of it, you know, and the council, you know, they're like, well, we're not going to vote to give you all the money. You know, we might want to put it to a public vote, yada, yada. But basically what's going on is, everything's set up, everything's moving forward,
and the council just has to vote on it, and they all want something else. You know, they all want something out of the deal that'll benefit them. This project is not, I mean, this is the main thing to take. You know, I can't give you any more than this. This is not a stadium. They're not just building a stadium. You know, that will never work. You know, you have to, the stadium has to be part of a much larger development, and that's what they've done. You know, they're doing a huge development, and the stadium is part of the development. You know, there's housing, there's parks, there's restaurants, there's roads,
right,
infrastructure and everything. And it's a huge project, and the stadium is part of it. So when you start, you know, if you're a city council person, you start, you know, with the, oh, I want this, I want that, we don't want to do this, you're kind of impacting right. more than just the baseball operations. You're impacting the whole community.
Steve, so, it's exactly what's going on here in Forsyth County. They have the commission passed for what they call the gathering, and it's going to have a facility in for hopefully a NHL team, but it's going to have all this restaurants, hotels, everything, and like the Battery, the way the Battery
right.
has developed.
Right.
Okay, and then what they've done with the Gwinnett Stripers is just on like a minor league Battery, I mean, over there. I mean, there's condos. People look at the game right off their porch on their condo. And that's exactly what this would be, that type of thing. The other thing is what they're looking at is now there's an arena over in Gaslight, I think it is, over in Gwinnett County, and that's where the minor league hockey team plays. And that's where Forsyth County goes for the majority of their high school graduations. Well, that's taking all the revenue out of Forsyth County into Gwinnett County. So this way, all the high school graduations would be in this new facility, too, where you're keeping all that revenue within the county. And I think that's exactly what you're saying is exactly what's being planned here.
I think owners, these owners that are trying to get money to, you know, to get these things built, I think the day that you can't do a stadium project anymore. You know, it doesn't help anybody, you know, to do a stadium project as a standalone and then hope that there's development around. I think what the Braves did is basically the template for what everybody wants now. You know, I think every owner of every sport wants that template. I mean, I think I read, you know, because the Braves do the SEC filing, and I think the revenue of that district around the Braves, you know, that they have is $50 million a year now.
Well, Steve, as always, thank you very, very much. Congratulations on another great 15, 20 minutes. And we'll get you
beautiful.
In a few weeks and see what's happening on the baseball front. I'll get to the Red Sox yet. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you. It was great talking to you all, and thanks for having Roy and I have a little conversation. I love talking to you.
Hey, that's great. Steve, you're the best. We appreciate it.
That's exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to hook you two guys up because you got on a little early, and Frank was telling me you were ready to go. So I said, let's get the two guys together. Thanks a lot. Okay, Trevor Musco is ready right now because we're going to switch to the UFL. First weekend of play was this weekend, and I know it's a big weekend for Trevor because he follows this sport very, very closely and also had a chance to see some of our local products get a little showing at 12 noon on Saturday. Trevor, what do we got?
So this past weekend was actually week two. The Birmingham Stallions are 2-0. San Antonio is 2-0. Both teams I was incredibly high on in the offseason. Wade Phillips and Skip Holtz, probably the two best coaches in the league, have their teams at 2-0. Two teams that are winless at the moment is the Arlington Renegades as well as the Houston Roughnecks. They both just can't seem to get it going. And then you obviously have the mid-table teams that are split down the middle at 1-1, like St. Louis, Michigan, Memphis, and so on and so forth. But overall, it's been looking pretty good, especially with TV numbers in week one. Both Fox games averaged over 1 million people watching, I think 1.2 and then 1.3. And then this past weekend, there was only one game on Fox, so that definitely hurt. The production value for ESPN and then Fox is staggeringly different. ESPN, I'm just going to be outright honest, is straight up horrible. Their commentators are getting stats and facts wrong on history of players, the former leagues, and all they seem to talk about is the over-under. With Fox, the graphics are better, the scoreboard looks nicer, transitions are smoother. Commentators are actually doing a respectable job. And I just wish that we got more on Fox. And then ABC is just a lost cause, in my personal opinion. But we got one of those games last weekend. We have two this weekend. So I'm not really sure what the plans are with the scheduling of, you know, which corporation gets to air what game. But I know ABC is an ESPN product, but I do hope that the postseason and the championship are televised on Fox accordingly just to draw the best numbers. But overall, things have looked really nice. St. Louis had 40,000 people in attendance this past weekend in their home opener. It's been a very exciting season so far.
Roger?
Well, ESPN got rid of quite a few of employees. And it's probably a lot of people that do behind the scenes, the stats, you know, bios and everything else. But I agree with you. I think they really don't have their act together, and Fox does. But I've thought that for quite a while. And if I had my wish, it would be that ESPN is sold by Disney, and that they keep ABC. And ABC has its own sports department, like we loved, right, Don and Frank, for many, many years with Wide World of Sports and all the great announcers that ABC had.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it looks more like it's going to be the other way around, that it's going to be, the other network is going to buy ABC out, I shouldn't say buy them out. They're already bought out, but they're going to merge together, and there's a lot of money involved in what they're going to do, I don't know. Who were the two announcers for the 12 o'clock game?
I don't know.
Trevor?
Honestly, I can't name any ESPN broadcasters in the UFL besides there's a former player. I think his name's like Emmanuel Acho, I think his name is. But I really can't. But Fox is a different story. Jake Butt, Devin Gardner, Joel Klatt, those guys are class acts, and ESPN is just – really hurting this league with the televised market of it all, because man, it's just not a good product when you're watching it on TV. Sometimes the transitions are glitched, the scoreboard's incorrect and they have to correct it, or there's freezing in the frames. It's really bad. And I agree with you, Disney buying this and then merging with ABC, it's just rotting this whole market and this whole space. Disney is not really good at handling and managing things, and I think we've seen it in this century. But, I do hope that they are going to trend more towards Fox-aired games, you know, going into later in the season. But, I mean, the attendance numbers have been solid in person. Like I said, St. Louis they broke a record from last year, which was set at 38,000 and some change. And, you know, this past weekend, St. Louis had over 40,000 people there. Pro Football Works in St. Louis. The NFL did them dirty with how St. Louis, the Rams left.
They did.
Yep. And it shows. I mean, they have a fan base willing to go out there and support their team. And A.J. McCarron and Anthony Becht, not really a fan of the head coach, Anthony Becht. He made some questionable calls. But A.J. McCarron has been playing his rear end off, making some really good throws, pretty much won that game in St. Louis. They really did not play well on defense, him driving the ball downfield in the fourth quarter. But the team that's impressed me the most is obviously the Birmingham Stallions. They're just hands down, I think, the best spring football team put on this earth. I really do. They start out 2-0 again. They've lost three games in three seasons now. What does that say? That's 25 games total now they've played, and they've only lost three. Skip Holtz is a wizard. I'm just going to say that. And San Antonio with Wade Phillips, they've also surprised people. Quarterback Chase Garbers is putting up, you know, up to this point, an MVP-type season. He has six touchdowns and one on the ground. Wade Phillips has turned this club around, and San Antonio is actually a watchable football team. Last year they were 3-7 in the XFL. Now they start out in 2-0. They're about to match their win total from last year with Wade Phillips. You know, Hines Ward was the head coach there last year, and it was just an abysmal setup they had going. Wade Phillips turns it around, and I got to pat myself on the back. These are two teams I've been saying, watch out. These are two teams we might see in the championship game in St. Louis, which will be played at the Superdome. So there's a high chance we might even get those kind of numbers for the championship as well, over 40,000 people. I mean, can you imagine that? That'd be awesome. A spring championship game with those kind of people, with that amount of people, that's history right there.
Hey,
Let me ask you this. Go ahead, Roger.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask one thing. I think when I watched a couple of games, I think Kurt Menefee, who's the anchor on the Fox pregame show for the NFL, I think he was doing the play-by-play. Okay, and also Don, you may have seen this because they had made an announcement on one of the pregame shows. He's now the co-host on Good Day New York on Fox 5 in New York. He's been there, I guess, for 6 months or so. And I'm just wondering if maybe they're going to make changes on the NFL Sunday show, because he's now, in New York all the time doing a daily show, and now he's doing the UFL. So you never know, but I'm sure Kurt Menefee was who I heard doing one of the UFL games.
You know, hey, I've never had an issue with a Fox broadcasted UFL game so far, and I do agree with you. I think Tom Brady definitely changed up the lineup in the Fox broadcasting booth with him in the picture now. I mean, he's the focal point for Fox when it comes to the NFL season. He's going to be – they're going to surround him and make a whole production, a whole show around him, so – everyone else kind of has to take a seat for a second, you know?
Well, you told me how much you're encouraged with what happened in St. Louis, and you're right, exactly right about that. The NFL still hasn't straightened out. I don't think those season tickets they sold for the NFL, and I don't know if they've paid those customers back yet. But, NFL was certainly solidly entrenched in St. Louis, and it was expected to be solidly entrenched now. But give me some of the attendance figures on the other teams, the teams that were not on television or the teams that were not broadcast, what did they do?
Oh, every team, every game was broadcasted. But the average outside of St. Louis does have the best fan base in this league by far, obviously, but it was around 13,000 to 15,000 respectively.
Okay.
So definitely a huge gap, but, there's still some fans in the stands, and they're trying to grow, and I think it will. It just has to come down to people still trying to figure out if they like this product, if they like the teams that, are in their local market, if they like some of these players. On social media, a lot of really good reactions, and TV ratings look solid right now, up 17% across the board in week two compared to XFL and USFL last year. Overall, it's improving. It's progressing the way it should. It's just there are things they definitely need to clean up with ESPN, like I said. But other than that, I mean, everything is going exactly how I planned, how I saw. Very good play, high competitive play, really good football players, good coaching, gritty games coming down to the wire. I mean, how Memphis lost this past weekend was simply amazing. How they lost that game was amazing. They allowed two touchdowns in 50 seconds. How the San Antonio Brahmas were able to do that. It was the 4th-and-12 conversion play. After you score a touchdown and go for the extra point, you can opt in instead of kicking it off. You can convert a 4th-and-12 to stay on the field on offense. You have to watch all 60 minutes of these games because it can go either way. 2 feet in bounds, it still has a professional feel to it. Mike Pereira, transparent in his calls on the field with the flagrant fouls and stuff like that. Overall, just really entertaining stuff. And if you haven't tuned into a game yet, I definitely recommend you do so.
Well,
Roger,
here's the teams. I was right. Kurt Menefee with Joel Klatt, okay? And he's renowned. And then you also have Brock Huard, the old quarterback, and then play-by-play Kevin Kugler, who does a lot of the Sunday night games, former Michigan quarterback Devin Gardner, a former Denver Broncos tight end Jake Butt, And then you also have Rodolfo Landeros, Jamie Mata, Jorge, or this is on Deportes. But what I gave you was the main announcers on Fox for the UFL.
Hey, Trevor, there was also a record, two weeks in a row, record field goals. You want to talk about that one?
Yeah, absolutely. In week one, Jack Bates, the guy that hasn't kicked a field goal since high school, comes on for the Michigan Panthers with 4 seconds left on the clock and seals the deal with a 64-yard kick for a field goal to beat the St. Louis Battlehawks in week one. And then last weekend, in week two, he was 100% on his accuracy, 3 for 3 on field goals, but he hits a 62-yarder in that game. The Detroit Lions have already given him a call, and there's good speculation he's going to be picked up by them immediately after this season. This guy is special. You don't run into guys like this. I mean, Brandon Aubrey was a big case, so, you know, but if you're able to find someone with this talent, you got to grab him. He has a leg. And when he hit the 64-yarder, it looked like he could have gone probably past 70 yards. He had air under the ball still. He was a special teams assistant in college, and he, again, didn't kick a field goal since high school until that 64-yard field goal in week one of the UFL. That was spectacular, absolutely spectacular. I was like, Mike Nolan marched him out on the field, and I'm like, they're not going to go for a Hail Mary here? What? And first of all, Anthony Beck, the head coach of the St. Louis Battlehawks, he ices him, and he still makes it. He has to go again, and he does it again. 2 64-yard field goals back-to-back. That is just insane. That's just
he's in Dempsey's league.
Yeah.
But you know, that is that, you're right. That is to do it back to back at 64 is remarkable. Was it indoors?
Oh yes,
no,
that was
outdoors.
At Ford Field. It was at Ford
Field. It was
Field.
Outdoors.
It's in the dome, yeah.
Okay. All right. Let me go back. You talked about the choice they made about taking the chance to re-kick again rather than kick the extra point. How did the new situation with the kickoffs and kick returns, how did that assimilate into what you thought it would?
The return yards are up. I've seen some good plays. Not one has been brought back for a touchdown yet, but special teams units have to be playing their rear ends off in this league, or you will get cut on a week-to-week basis or moved down to the inactive roster. So, in my opinion, I think it's definitely nice that we're getting the traditional kickoff. It's weird that the NFL is going to be moving towards the XFL kickoff, but I've liked it so far. I really have. I think the big
Roger.
Thing, though, because they do move the ball back when the kicker kicks it on the kickoff. So it's back at their own 20. So like they are encouraging
right.
them to return it. No fair catches. But no, it's been solid special teams play. Like really professionally sound, in my opinion.
Trevor, you think the NFL will pick up more of their concepts?
I think that they'll definitely probably use this league as a trial and error, kind of system to where the NFL will implement rules into the UFL or suggest rules so that the UFL can try them out for a year or two or maybe even longer, and then maybe the NFL will start adopting them down the line. But I don't see them taking anything that the UFL is doing this year. I really don't see them taking away the field goal kick after touchdown, because in the UFL there's no kicking after touchdowns. That maybe the NFL does go for that. That's more points on the board, but that would just look – a little funky in the NFL. I do like it in the UFL. It makes it a little more exciting. I would actually appreciate maybe instead of just only one overtime quarter, if it's still tied after one overtime, they go to like the shootout, which is what the UFL does in overtime. Instead of actually playing a traditional game, each offense gets three times with the ball to punch it into the end zone. Each time they do, it's 2 points. Best out of three wins the game. I like that. It's kind of like football, a.k.a. soccer. But I think they will start testing stuff out in the UFL, but I don't know if they're going to immediately start taking things from the UFL, because there's not really much data to measure the success of some of these new rules and stuff. They're going to need a good body of work to draw that from. So maybe in year maybe three, of the UFL, we might see something get adopted by the NFL, or maybe the UFL adopts more NFL stuff. Who knows? Because they did not ban the hip drop tackle. They let you hit in this league, thank God. But I understand the injury concerns of it, but at the end of the day, we can't make defensive players defenseless anymore. It's really getting to the point where they're encouraging 40 to 40 point games every game in the NFL, or at least that's what they want. Not many teams can provide that, but in the UFL, at least you can get that grittiness and that clash of both sides of the ball. You know, there's not just an air raid offense that's dominating and no one that can really pick up anyone because they can't get physical, you know, and I feel like I'm scared that's where the NFL is heading.
Trevor, you're talking about back-to-back 64-yard field goals, one because they tried to ice them, but where is this? You mentioned he was an assistant coach somewhere. I mean, how old is he? Where has he been if the NFL scouts kickers as well as they scout kickers? Where's this guy been?
Well, he didn't kick a field goal since high school. He was a special teams assistant. He was on the football team in college, but he just didn't suit up. It's a weird scenario.
Where did he go?
Soccer in college.
What school?
I think it was a small school. I'm not really sure off the top of my head. I don't want to give you the incorrect answer there, but definitely a small school. I mean, guys like this probably get missed all the time. But definitely amazing to see the leg strength on display there. I mean, an NFL team could definitely use that, especially the Green Bay Packers. Their kicker was horrible in the playoffs. But, I mean, so many other teams could use a guy with that kind of leg strength. I mean, seriously, that is something Justin Tucker did.
Anybody
can
use that. Roger?
Yeah, I agree. The what do you think so far, Trevor, is the strength of the league? You know, passing, defense, running, you tell me. Tell us.
I personally believe that the biggest strength of this league is defense. I think that tackling is really good. Like, they let you hit. They let you play. I mean, the officiating, you know, gets a little spotty sometimes with the amount of flags thrown. But keep in mind, these are rookie-esque refs. But just the transparency also of, like, how these flags are called and why they're called. I also really enjoy the element of the Super Challenge. It's called the Super Challenge. It's pretty much a challenge. But you can challenge any outcome on the field at any time in the game. If you believe the refs missed a pass interference call, you can throw the Super Challenge. If you win it, you win it. If you lose it, you lose a timeout, and you lose your Super Challenge either way. You only have won a game. But I like that aspect to it. You're giving the coaches more control. You also have more communication with your players. You have a 15-second, like, stop in between the time the ball snapped, and you can stop talking to your coaches and your offensive coordinator in the NFL. They stop you from talking to your coaching staff at 15 seconds on the play clock. In this, you can talk to your players up until the play, sometimes through, like, while the play is going on. Like, and they only let you look at pictures and still frame shots of the former play and the previous play in the NFL. In this, you're actually able to watch the full play. You're able to, you know, analyze the defense, break it down. Honestly, I understand that, you know, there's the element of these guys do need a little extra assistance, but it's a little more, it makes it more competitive. It really does. It makes it more gritty. It makes it more, I don't know, fun. Like, I don't remember, you know, obviously besides watching the Lions play, but I don't watch an NFL, like a random NFL game, like I watch a random UFL game and have this amount of fun. Like, I can watch it and actually have a lot of enjoyment. There's a lot of really good plays, a lot of blunders that lead into fun plays, exciting, entertaining, electric, you know, playmaking abilities from guys that should be in the NFL, but you learned, oh, wait, Daywood Davis and the Memphis Showboats got carted off in the preseason for the Miami Dolphins last year. Definitely should be on a roster, but injury prohibited him. You know, he got limited there and never really got a chance to shine. And then you look at Case Cookus when Brock Purdy, you know, couldn't throw in that NFC Championship game. Case Cookus was on the practice squad of the San Francisco 49ers. If you elevated him, who knows? I don't know. You know, they're not winning, but it would have looked better. It's just one of those things where, like, opportunity is what's at stake here, and you can see that on the field. You can see the determination by a lot of these
guys.
How did Vinny
do in the first game? How did Vinny do?
Vinny had a few catches. He had a toe drag, touchdown grab. This past game, he had a single catch. He was kind of Yeah, I'm sure he would, if he was here, he would say he could have done better, but he's definitely been a big part of the Memphis Showboats offense. They definitely shouldn't have lost last week, but they just couldn't punch it into the red zone, period. They were in the red zone five times, only scored one touchdown. So you're not winning games like that, and plus they let the San Antonio Brahmas score two touchdowns in 50 seconds, which is still probably the greatest comeback in spring football history. Great game. But the Brahmas are definitely a team to look out for. The Showboats, after last week's loss, they lost a lot of people's respect, I'll say that much. They definitely have to go back to the drawing board, but I really do like John DeLocipio, the head coach of Memphis. Really passionate about the game, knows what he's doing, but he just really can't let his defense blunder the way it did. And I really like Darnell Lake, who's the defensive coordinator there. He's done a lot of really good things with players like Tyree Woods, Maximilian Roberts, John Atkins.
All right, Trevor, hold it right there. We're out of time in this segment, but thank you very, very much. We'll check in next week. I know you're pleased with the first couple of weeks, so we'll pick it up from there and see how the league continues to progress. Thanks so much, Trevor.
Thank you,
have
guys. You guys
week,
have a
Trevor.
Nice rest of your night.
You too.
I appreciate you.
Mike Simzak's up the line next, the Baltimore, Washington area. A lot of activity down the Baltimore, Washington area right now. We talked some baseball earlier, but I want to go to his Brett Bailiwick. Mike, soccer, give us an idea of what's on the front burners right now in the world of soccer.
Well, the U.S. women on penalties in an absolutely amazing game against Canada took the Sheep Leafs Cup last night. Was all the great that you want to watch.
Where was that played, Mike?
I think it was down in your neck of the woods in Florida.
Oh, okay, in Florida. Okay.
But Alyssa Nehar got a couple of saves. It was just a phenomenal game to watch. MLS has come out with some new roster rules. Gentlemen, I'll be real honest with you. I've been talking to you for the better part of 10 years now. I still can't figure out what to make roster rules with MLS. I know a lot of my stuff, but that's one thing I can't figure out. I think it means teams can spend more money, but I'm not 100% sure.
Roger?
Well, the MLS is underway, and there's been some activity, and we haven't talked to you in several weeks, Mike. So, we love you.
Yeah, a lot of that is my fault.
No problem. we love talking to you, and now we can get caught up on the MLS since the season's underway.
Listen, Roger. Last time we talked, the Philadelphia Unions sucked. This time we talked, they're up to second in the Eastern Conference. That tells you what a difference a couple of weekends can make. They have a game. Union are playing Atlanta United. I fully believe that Philadelphia Union were focusing on the CONCACAF Champions League the first couple of weeks of the season, which would explain why they had three consecutive draws. Now they're coming off the back of three consecutive wins that have catapulted them up the standings. And so this game could be really, really interesting on this weekend.
Roger?
Yeah. Well, no, I thought that was going back to you, Don. So the Union have really turned it around. And I know the United – hold on one second. I want to go off the speaker. I know that the United, they had made an acquisition. I read that, but it wasn't something that, really took the market by storm, if you know what I mean. You know, like a big name.
Mm-hmm.
But I get those emails, and I looked at it, and you track, the league and all these personnel moves. And have they made some pretty decent moves, the United? I know they're doing a lot of things. I can tell you that in the community.
Roger, I'm not going to lie and say that I understand every move that Atlanta United has made. I do know that they have rebuilt a team. They have another couple of weeks left in the transfer window for MLS to sign players.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They have built what we think to be a solid club. But as I have told you and Dawn for the last, I mean, since I've been doing this show, when it comes to the MLS, the margins are very, very thin. What we think could be a good move may not necessarily be. It all depends.
Mm-hmm.
And you think that you got this, and it may or may not work out. So I have to see how this plays out on the field.
The last time we spoke, Mike, was Washington was making a little bit of thrust toward getting into the playoffs. It's leveled off again a little bit. How do you see what's happening down in the National Hockey League with Washington?
They are, unless things have changed in the last couple of minutes, when I checked today, they were in the playoffs. But that I have to qualify it and say things might have changed in the last couple of minutes, since I parked my car, tells you how thin that margin is.
Yeah, it is. It's like four teams with like three or four points.
And any one of them could.
Right.
I kind of think that's kind of where they wanted to be this year. They wanted to be in the playoff mix. You've got a very – the only way that I can call the Caps right now is a Franken team. It's assembled by about six different coaches. It's got one superstar, and now you've got a head coach, Spencer Carberry, who they believe, but they're still trying to manage how to handle having a guy like Ovechkin and then having older guys like Oshie still on the roster – where you know you need to rebuild, but you also still want to be in the playoffs because you want to give Ovechkin another playoff run. It is
right.
One of the most awkward jobs that you could have as a coach. And I'm going to tell you both, I think whether or not he gets votes, I think Spencer Carberry has been the manager, the coach of the year. What he has done just to keep the Caps in playoff contention has been nothing short of amazing, given that he's got a roster that was built by about five different head coaches.
Right.
And you got to make it work.
But you got Washington, you got Pittsburgh, and you got the Islanders all thinking that they're on the cusp of getting in or not getting in. And, it's going to looks to me from here as though it's going to come down to either the last game of the regular season or the next to last game of the regular season. I don't see how they could separate.
Somebody's going to have to get on a streak and go, Don. Like, somebody's going to have to actually prove to be better than the rest of those teams. And the funny thing is we're talking about the bottom end of the Eastern Conference.
Right.
It's not like we're talking about the top end. We're talking about the bottom end. If any one of these teams wins a series, go on, fall on to them. But, you got to be in the playoffs to win it, and that's where we're all trying to get to.
Well, especially with Ovechkin. You want him in there.
You want him in there. Last night he set a record. 18 seasons of 30 goals plus. Even Wayne Gretzky didn't do that. That tells you what a phenomenal player Alexander Ovechkin has been. And we want to get him in the playoffs. We want to see him competing. But to be honest, there aren't the horses around him right now for him to make another championship run. And that's
Roger.
Just being real honest.
Roger?
Well, yeah, so you don't see them really. I mean, they may get in the playoffs, but you don't see them challenging. Just like we don't think if the Flyers get in the playoffs, they're not going to challenge. You know, they've been in a free fall, but they could, you know, turn around and maybe win, you know, a few games. But I just wanted to get back to soccer for a second. The one thing, I don't know whether you have the CBS Sports app or not. Okay. I mean, I do.
I do.
And, okay. What amazed me, and Don, I don't know whether you have it or not, or Frank has it, amazed me was the way that soccer, I wouldn't say monopolizes, because it's not, because you get baseball, you get your favorite teams. But when I was looking for scores of the Final Four, soccer, you had to, it seems like you had to go through soccer to get to college basketball. And I don't know whether you've noticed that, Mike, or not.
Well, you know, part of it, Roger, is CBS and Bleacher Report shuffled the NCAA tournament off to HBO Max. So if you really wanted to watch all the games, and I know this because that was my experience trying to get the early rounds of the NCAA, they put them on HBO Max.
Well, I was just wanting to get the scores on the CBS Sports app. And they have, like, the Premier League, the European League. They got everything on there.
We are at the business end of the season, and there are any number of things going on all at the same time. We had the quarterfinals yesterday and today of the Champions League. Tomorrow will be the quarterfinals of the Europa League and the European Conference Championship. So there are seriously three tournaments all going on at the same time. Meanwhile, in each country, we're down to the last, you know, six, eight, nine games that will define who is going to be in various countries, because mm-hmm. each country has a different league that will define who's going to be the champion, who's going to be relegated. You know, right now is a phenomenal time to start and watch to watch soccer, because everything is going on. Teams that you may know of because you watch Netflix series, Sunderland, Wrexham, they're all competing in something to get promoted, to avoid relegation. Historic teams that we may know because they had cool names and USA players used to play for them, Sheffield Wednesday, competing to not get relegated. To answer your question, Don, or Roger, you know, this is the most interesting time of the year to be a soccer fan, because there's just so much going on.
Well, there's a lot on that app, I can tell you that.
Well, the big thing was, Roger, you had to know all the channels that were covering, you know, the basketball tournaments, whether it be the men's tournament or the women's tournament, because, you know, it was very difficult if you didn't have a sheet in front of you to follow what network it was going to be on at what time. It was very difficult to, you know, get scores that you wanted, you know, right then. So I agree with you. I think that because of the fact there are so many channels involved now, not just with soccer, but with everything. If you're a baseball fan, you don't know whether it's on Fox Sports 1, you don't know whether it's on, you don't know what channels are on.
You're right.
Don and Roger, it's not even that you needed to know what channels. You needed to know different apps. I would never have thought that I needed to look on HBO to see the NCAA tournament. And trust me, the first weekend, or the first Thursday and Friday, I struggled to find the games, because I was like, I don't know what app these games are streaming on anymore. That was a failure on the NCAA's part. How did you not tell me where I need to look to see these?
Well, that's why I say you had to have the newspaper, because they gave you, not only did they give you the times, but they also gave you the network that the games were going to be broadcast on. And, you know, were you to think that we're going to be on AT&T or Turner Broadcasting, or they're going to be on CBS? I assumed, to be honest with you, the finals are going to be automatically on CBS, but they weren't.
No, CBS.
That's what I mean. I mean, you see, you don't know.
Don, I'm Gen X, so I at least I've seen a newspaper in my life, but I'm also Gen X, so I'm used to dealing with apps.
Yeah. But
seriously,
but
you
know,
are
the other
telling
thing
me
is...
that I need to look in a newspaper, one of which I have not seen in the last 25 years.
Well,
to figure out
that's
where,
why that's
what,
why I get the newspapers, Mike, because I know what's going on.
I haven't seen a newspaper in 25 years.
Yeah,
and there are a lot of people just like you. Wait a minute, there are a lot of people. Roger will tell you there are a lot of people just like you. He calls me up all the time. And says, did you see this app? Did you see? I don't want to know about that. I know where I want. I know the games I want to see, and all I have to do is look at the New York Post, and he lists every game and every channel and every time. And you don't have to look at any nonsense. And that's what I want to do. I want to look at the paper and see what's coming up. But you can't do that. You can't deal with soccer. You can't deal with football. You can't deal with anything.
But Mike is right, Don. What they should have done, the NCAA is at fault because they have an app. Just like the Masters has a great app. But the NCAA's on their
own. That was the funny thing.
Well,
they have one. When it was on the CBS app, Roger, and they had the boss button, it was freaking amazing. You could put it up all day, and then they had a button up in the corner. So if
yeah,
the supervisor walked by, you.
Well, I got to tell you, we're running, Mike, we're running out of time in this segment. Doug's ready to go, but I'll give you one last word. I'll give you one last word on the telecast. If you wanted to watch the women's game and you didn't know it was on ABC. And you knew that it was on ESPN, and you saw those three women broadcasters talking all during the game. I don't know whether you guys ever watched any of it, but all during the game on ESPN, they had three. Well, I wouldn't want to say that, but there's three women talking about the game while you're sitting here trying to watch it. You had to watch it on ABC. You couldn't watch it at all on ESPN. They took away from the whole game. But we got to run.
That was the same as the Manning.
Quick before we get off, I know that you got to let me go, but I know Doug is coming on. Doug, how about Jackson Holliday coming up to the O's? I'm going to leave you in. You go with that.
Right.
Have a good week, Mike.
Take care, Mike.
All right, gentlemen. Talk to you later.
He should have broke spring training with the Orioles because, you know.
You said
Tony
that
Kemp
last
was,
week.
Well, Tony Kemp was a joke to have him. I mean, he got cut by the bleeping Oakland A's, and he's, you know, at one point in time, okay, I know that he had some ties to Mike Elias and the Astros, and he was a good player college. He was a good, you know, pro player. But, I mean, we're holding a spot, you know, for this guy to do what, and I'd rather have Jackson Holliday in the clubhouse. I mean, it's a no-brainer. I mean, there's about five or six guys that you could put their name in a hat, and you could have picked one of their names out of the hat, and I don't care who it was, but they deserve to have that spot over Jackson Holliday. And there was some kind of stat nerd on – I was listening to 105.7, and he somehow had a computer program or an algorithm or something that he used to determine that if you took all the AAA teams across, you know, Major League Baseball for the designated affiliates, that the Norfolk Tides – would have, if they competed in a major league season, they would have won 56 games this year. So, I mean, that says a lot about, you know, the guys that they have at that next level. And, you know, I just wholeheartedly understand that we need to have some depth, and I understand the concept there, but, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you have these guys knocking on the door. I mean, Heston Kerstad at the AAA levels played 10 games so far for Norfolk. He has 25 RBI. You know, Connor Norby has 15 RBI. You know, Kobe Mayo's hitting 400. I mean, those guys are there. They're ready, you know, and, you know, we're watching Ramon Urias sub 100. We're watching, you know, some of these guys just not be able to get it done, and I don't understand why we're blocking them from playing Major League Baseball when they're ready.
What's been the reaction in Baltimore with the papers and the radio stations? Are they screaming the same way? Are they saying, where are these guys?
Yeah, I think you have, you know, some ranges of, you know, apoplectic when it comes to, you know, the media and the fans. And, I mean, I personally sent Mike Elias about 12 Twitter feeds that say, look, buddy, you know, what are we doing here? I mean, what are we trying to build? We had a 101-win season last year, and you think the addition of Tony Kemp is going to get us to 102? You know what I mean? Like, what's the thought process behind? I mean, you had, you know, most of these guys break spring training and performed incredibly well at that level, and you've got to give them a chance to, you know, see what they can do at that next level. And I'm one, like, you look at some of the depth that they have, and there's guys on that AAA team like Kyle Stowers that he hit 7 home runs in spring training. But I don't – honestly, I mean, he's – we have 3 major league outfielders in Mullins, Santander, and Hayes, and then you add Kerstad and Calder. So, I mean, he's 6th in line, right? So where's he going to – how's he going to get his chance? So I think that the Orioles have a very glaring need at the back end of their bullpen that they need to figure out how they're going to solve. And to me, Kyle Stowers is a part of that, you know, in terms of a trade piece. Can he go somewhere else and at least play? And can we get something in return that flashes something that we need? So, I mean, the fans are pretty irate looking at Austin Hayes hitting .120 and Urias hitting .088 and, you know, some of these guys, I think, so the fans are really, really, you know, wanting to see some of this next-level talent.
Roger?
Well, I'm looking at BaltimoreBaseball.com right now,
mm-hmm.
Doug.
Mm-hmm.
And Elias on trade interest, the timetable, preparing for the Rule 5 draft.
Yeah.
This is a while ago. I mean, but mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this is several years ago, but could it be that they're worrying about certain things about the time to sign so that the clock doesn't start until next month?
There's certainly a case to be made for the business side of that decision. But, you know, if that were to be the case, Jackson Holliday wouldn't be where he is currently. I think the timetable for him to have not lost a year was after May 1, you know, from that business standpoint. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think, you know, as I mentioned, I mean, how are you going to build on 101 wins? You know, that's the honest to God question mark in Baltimore. We made the playoffs. We won the division. You know, we were the number one seed. And, you know, we got shown the door, if you will, you know, by the Texas Rangers. So how are we going to make improvements on that? You know,
right.
I think going out, getting Corbin Burns was a tremendous feather in their cap.
Absolutely.
You know, to take a step in that direction. You know, I think Kimbrel was, you know, I mean, that you could have done much worse. I'm not convinced that he's going to be our closer for the entire season. I'm not convinced that Kyle Bradish is going to pitch this year, although he's started his rehab assignments. You know, John Means will come back. He is pitching better. He didn't pitch very well in his first rehab. He threw okay at the AAA level in his second. Brandon Hyde has indicated that he's going to take most of the 30-day rehab period to work that out before he comes back. As a fan, I cannot watch Cole Irvin pitch every 5 days. I just can't do it. I mean, you know, we're going to lose every 5th game. I mean, that's about the size of it unless – you know, we can score a ton of runs and get our offense going there. But
what option does Bride have?
What's that? What's the question?
What options does he have? Does he have another pitcher that he can use? Even if he went to a bullpen series, what would he do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we're missing one power arm at the back of that bullpen. You know, Cionel Perez tweaked something in his oblique, I think. So, I mean, there was one, you know, obviously not.
Yeah, you're talking about the fifth starter. Go back to the fifth starter. What options does he have? Yeah, what options does he have for a fifth starter?
he's going to have to float, you know, and tread water until John Means comes back. That's probably his best option. But I don't think they have – I mean, Cade Povich, I thought he pitched pretty well in spring training.
Right.
He's a pretty crafty lefty who had a ton of strikeouts, you know, at various levels that he pitched. I mean, I'd rather watch that kid pitch than Cole Irvin. I just – he's not going to be a part of what we're doing moving forward. And that's – my concept is if, you know, you're building something, you want those blocks to be something that can be, you know, implemented and they can stay there. Cole Irvin's not a part of that. He just isn't. He's not going to be. I mean, I think at least if Means and Bradish were to come back healthy, at least we can put Tyler Wells in that – sixth starting spot slash long man in the bullpen. Maybe he can, you know, so there's some things that we can do there, but Cole Irvin's not a part of that. He's just trying to eat innings right now.
Okay. Roger.
Well, I know what Don's point was, for the Phillies, they had gotten to bolster the pitching staff, and it was for the relievers. But they've mm-hmm. had to use him as a starter, and fortunately, he's done okay. And mm-hmm. That's Spencer Turnbull, you know, 31 yeah. years old, and he's pitched a couple of really good games. But what they really expected him to be was in the bullpen because they had Ty Cann, the guy that was on the Mets,
Walker.
And he's been – Yeah, Walker, and he's hurt, okay? Mm-hmm. But I think he's going to go into a rehab. So I give Dombrowski a lot of credit that he was able to get Turnbull because he's really saved them in the first couple weeks of the season.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's always nice to have some level of organizational depth. But I think, you know, an ancillary answer to your question, Don, would be I think – you know, if you're going to hold on to certain prospects for whatever reason you want to, I don't know, you know, depth, or you're going to claim that, you know, your system's the best or whatever. I mean, at some point, I think you have to go to that cookie jar and say, you know, hey, look, man, we need a fifth starter and we need a bullpen arm or whatever. And, you know, in case of emergency break glass, you might have to trade a Stowers. You might have to, you know, I mean, look, I think Ramon Urias he's obviously a plus defender because he's a Gold Glove winner, and I get that. That's nice, you know. But, you know, if you're telling me I have the option of Ramon Urias at third base or I can call up Kobe Mayo or Connor Norby, I'd rather do that, you know. Let these guys play. I mean, what are we waiting for?
Well, you're an advocate, obviously, of letting the prospects play and the fellows that have proven themselves to be mediocre or less to be moved mm-hmm. out. And
yeah.
I can't disagree with that. But I was just referring to the fact that, you know, maybe he doesn't have a fifth option for them. He's got to throw somebody that and just sure. take a chance that he's going to throw a good game because he doesn't have any he has nowhere else to go.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of you're right. I mean, that's kind of where they are right now with, you know, if we throw him out there every fifth day, I mean, can we get a good start, quality start out of him, or can we have a game where we score more runs than they do get it done that way? I mean, I understand the logic, but that's what I'm saying is if you're Mike Elias, wherever you are right now, you're watching this guy pitch. He did not pitch well in spring training. He did not pitch well his first outing. He's not pitching well tonight. At last I saw, he had given up at least three runs. You have to think in your mind that this is a problem, right? So what is the actual answer? Like, how are we going to fix this? Because if we lose every fifth day, that's a problem for our longevity in the season. What are we going to do about this?
Well,
right?
This might be his final start. If you say he gave up three runs already tonight, this may be his final start at the number five position.
His ERA is 7.2. I mean, that's one start. I get it. But, you know, my son was watching the beginning of the game, and he looks at me, and he goes, 7.2? He goes, not very good, is it, Dad? And I was like, you know what, buddy? I was like, it's really, really good if your team can score 8 runs.
Roger, you're up.
Well, you know, I saw the Phillies traded Connor Brogdon to the Dodgers for this young left-handed pitcher,
than Onobi Robles. And they also made a couple of other moves. And the one I saw today was that they got this young kid for cash from the Chicago White Sox that they really people talk very highly about him, Jose Rodriguez, 22 years old, and they sent him to Reading. But, you know, I think it's deals like that that really really tell the story on whether you have a good organization, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you've got different levels of talent that people are searching for in terms of guys that are scouting and looking for different things. And, you know, over the course of time, you see how these teams are constructed with, as you previously mentioned, you've got the regular draft, you've got free agents that are available, you've got Rule 5, you've got waiver wire and those sorts of things, you've got trades. I mean, you've got many different ways to shape your team. And what you see in somebody else, you know, when you see a guy that's got a power arm that throws 95 and he can't find home plate, well, do you think that your guys can do something different? You know, is there a pitch that he's throwing that he shouldn't be? Is there a pitch that he should be throwing that he's not? Is there a mechanical concept that we can fix? You know, I mean, what sort of, you know, thing are we looking at here? And that's why people take a chance on a lot of these guys.
No question. I mean, that's what basically that's what your scouts and what your coaches are supposed to be working on. They're supposed to be able to differentiate between a guy that can't throw a two-seamer as opposed to a four-seamer. Mm-hmm. If you can't throw a four-seamer over the plate, it's not going to do him any good.
Sure. That's right. You know, that pitch mix is everything. And you see these guys, and that's the thing. Like, when these guys go to spring training and you watch a guy like Corbin Burns pitch and you say, oh, well, he didn't pitch very well today because he gave up, you know, three runs in two innings or whatever. Well, what people don't know is that the entire second inning, every single pitch he threw was a cutter. Like, he was specifically working on that pitch during that inning and didn't deviate. Like, he wasn't pitching like he was pitching in the major leagues with mixing up, you know, up, down, in and out and changing speeds and all that stuff. He was specifically working on throwing a cutter, and he threw it every single pitch to every single batter, right? So, you know, those are misleading, you know, concepts when people don't understand what happened, because most of the time we're not even watching those games because they're not even televised, right? So you can't really see that.
But that's what spring training is all about, to work on a pitch you want to develop. That's not, you know, that's why people take spring training numbers, throw them out the window, because that's not what they're working on. They're working on developing a particular pitch or a particular something that they want to do that they've been doing that hasn't worked.
And most of the – well, I mean, you're looking at some of the basic concepts of pitchers fielding their position, bunting, base running, you know, those sorts of things are always going to be omnipresent. But then, you know, you look at other concepts like, you know, the veterans. They're not looking to play every day in spring training. They're looking to get however many at-bats they feel like they need to get themselves ready for the season. So, you know, if they hit 200 or whatever and they got their 35 at-bats, they're good. You know, that's just the way – it's the way they gear themselves.
Right.
Long season.
Roger.
They're playing 162 games.
No, there's no doubt, and it's not like football, okay, where – because now football's not like football was, you know, with two a day, three a day. It's Don and I remember with Dick Vermeil, okay?
No pads.
I mean, those days are no pads. Now it's no pads, yeah. It's crazy. And
Let me ask you this, Doug, off the wall. Did you watch any of the UFL weekend?
Well, I'm part and parcel to the Defenders, obviously, being the Washington-based team, and I think they're more interested in how many solo cups they could put in their beer snake as opposed to the actual football game. So, I mean, I don't really pay attention to the concept of spring football, only because it's just not a household thing for me. I mean, we're obviously Ravens, and, well, most of us are Ravens, but some Redskins kind of in the family, and you know, that to me just kind of trumps everything.
Are you excited,
Roger,
about the my Masters this week, Doug, where we can really
some
golf next week?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that obviously this is one of the, you know, the four majors. This is one of the biggest. I mean, this is, you know, kind of the kickoff to the season in terms of what we're looking for. So, yeah, I mean, you hope for good weather down there. You know, there's a whole bunch of PGA professionals like me that are down there watching, you know, what's happening in terms of the practice rounds and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's a geek fest in terms of, you know, all the people that are watching it and all the things that happen.
Tomorrow, you know, does not look good.
Some rain in the forecast.
Heavy wind and rain until at least 1 o'clock.
Yep. So, yeah, they may have to find an alternative way to get these first two rounds in, whether they, you know, go off.
Too bad, because Tiger's ready to go, and just have to wait and see what happens in that regard. But the bigger story is taking over the leadership in 25, the Ryder Cup. So we'll see what happens there. First time he's made an overture to go in that direction. Fellas, we got a call tonight. Thank you very much.
Have a good week,
care.
Doug.
Take care, Roger. I'll talk to you later.
You too. God bless. Take care.
Ladies and gentlemen, these programs are brought to you each and every night of the week in grateful appreciation. Men and women of the United States Armed Forces, among men and women of police and fire services, doctors and nurses, and the first responders at the fight against COVID. These programs are dedicated to those who have lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman Jeffrey Colcap, Patrolman Jeffrey David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazowitz, Sergeant Thomas Batinger, San Diego Officer Mike Hendler, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, Sergeant Tom Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Department, Patrolman Charlie Connett, Tarpon Springs Police Department, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Sergeant James O'Neill, Philadelphia Police Department, Sergeant Chris Levick, Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department, Lieutenant Mike Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Patrolman Anoffa Christen, Lakeley PD, Deputy Josh Meyer, Nassau County Sheriff's Department, Captain Matt Letourneau, Philadelphia Fire Department, Captain Chris Leach, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Artith Hope, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Ficus, Wilmington Fire Department, Chief Al Hogo, Longboat Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Trooper Chelsea Richards, Florida Highway Patrol, Trooper Joe Bullock, Florida Highway Patrol, Deputy Mike Hargrove, Pinellas County Sheriff's Department, Trooper Joe Zachary Bain, Florida Highway Patrol, Sergeant Chris Fitzgerald, Philadelphia Police Department, Temple University Police Department, and Sergeant Ramon Mendez, Philadelphia Police Department, and Philadelphia Airport Police. My brothers and sisters, letting me be 10-7 at this point in time. Sometime we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the rose rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the rains fall softly on your fields and the sunshine light on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your family always in the hollow of his hands. God bless and have a great week.
Shem alek ma yilama, shem ahezah yilama, son ashen evorat fet hakuig again ma yilama. Shem alek ma yilama, shem in the field.
County Dispatch to 1999. All units be advised, 1999's responded to his last emergency. May God rest his soul and all the souls of the faithful departed. Hey, Bob, we love you and we miss you.